This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Muslims in Norway are now establishing a masjid and dawah center to enhance the Norwegian dawah. If you donate to this cause, you will inshallah reap the rewards of thousands of Muslims coming back to Islam, and many of those will become du'at and invite to Islam. So click the link and donate now and share the video for extra reward.
So, okay, egoism is the idea of self-interest, self-love, okay? Self-interest, selfishness, okay? Self-love, yeah? Now, psychological egoism is the idea that we, as human beings, are self-interested by nature. That everything that we do is for ourselves. Every single thing you do is for yourself. Is this a moral claim?
No.
It's not a moral claim, because we're not saying it should be, ought to be, it's okay for it to be, it's good for it to be for yourself. But that's why it's called psychological egoism. Psychologists speak about it. It's the field now of psychology. So everything you do is for yourself. This is a very important question. I'm going to pause here and I want you to really think about this. To what extent do you agree with this statement? 3 minutes, speak to the person next to you. Really think about it.
Obviously,
let's get back and there's some interesting conversations going on here. Why don't you bring it to us? Tell us what you're talking about.
Yeah, so we mentioned that there is definitely truth in this. In that a person usually, you know, when they live their daily life, they do things out of self-interest. Yeah. You know, whether it be work and so on, and also out of self-love. And the reason a person does something is usually to fulfill like a kind of a satisfaction within themselves, whether it's like mental, biological, and the financial, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then we kind of progress on, so go, okay, how about a mother who loves her child? You know, usually a mother would sacrifice her own interests, her own well-being for the sake of her child. But then a person might be able to argue and say that a mother is only doing this to fulfill her own biological needs, her own instinctual needs, right? However, is this the same as her sacrificing herself from a psychological standpoint? Like, because psychologically her interest would still be to, you know, like, I don't know, to eat this plate of food rather than give it to her child. So it's like there's a confliction of like biological need and her like psychological kind of interest there.
Yes, yeah, I think you're definitely thinking about it on the right tracks, and this is exactly the kind of conversations that I had. You know, on the example of the mother sacrificing herself for the child, it could very well be argued that she's doing that because she couldn't live with herself if she didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
She'd rather live a life where she would rather not live than have to live a life thinking that she didn't save her child. So the pain of not sacrificing her child, herself for her child, would be more than the pleasure that she would have living the rest of her life in guilt.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of arguments, and you know,
so that would be the grenade example.
Pardon?
If there's a grenade.
Grenade.
Yeah.
Yeah, the grenade example is actually one that's sort of used as well, like, you know, and you know, jumping on a grenade and stuff. But then, the question is that person doing it to leave some kind of a legacy behind?
Yeah.
Or because they think that this is what's going to really, like, the thought of them doing that will make them into some kind of a historical figure.
Or if they don't do it.
Yeah. But if they don't do it, then it's, for example, the nation will be destroyed, his family will be raped, his house will be taken.
Or he's mentally not going to live.
Or mentally he can't live with the pain.
Yeah.
And or a combination of all of those factors.
Yeah.
So then he ultimately reasons, I'm going to jump on this grenade and be brave. And that makes me a man, or that makes me a patriot, or that makes me a true warrior or something. You know. Any other points on this?
Basically, we agree with the other guys. There's always a degree of self-interest, whether that's an internal happiness that you gain from something, or you can gain the exterior adulation of other people by doing something.
Yeah.
So there's always some form of self-interest involved.
Do you know, it's very good, well put. I think that's absolutely, I think it's very difficult to argue against this. Basically, I think it has been very difficult for anyone to argue against in psychology. and even in philosophy to a lesser extent. But what I find interesting is there's been a proliferation recently in the last, I would say, 20 or 30 years, especially, of literature and psychology about narcissism. I'm not sure if you've seen this. There's even YouTube channels being established, how to deal with a narcissist and how to do this and that.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks everyone else is the narcissist, but everyone has the narcissist in them, you know? And the conventional model, right, is you've got a spectrum. I'm not sure if you've seen the spectrum or if you've heard of it, but you've got on the one side, you've got the overt narcissist. And then on the other side, you have what you call the covert narcissist. And these are two sides of, it's like a spectrum, right? So the overt narcissist is an exhibitionist. Comes across as extremely confident, basically like me. You know, they will openly tell you what they, you know, what they want in life and what they will, they're very disagreeable, these kind of things. That one is easy to identify, but the covert narcissist, they're more difficult to identify because they can be introverted. They're introverted. In relationship psychology, by the way, a lot of the times, for better or worse, it's attributed to the woman in the relationship. So the man, he's trying to dominate his partner through overt means, you know, trying to shout at her, talk to her, threaten, whatever. The woman, what she'll do, you know, this is a simplistic model of, you know, covert narcissism. And what she'll do a lot of the time, she'll, okay, stay quiet, whatever. And then she'll leverage the man in a way which is more subtle. She'll go speak to her friends about him. She'll make a plan with her mum about the guy. And so, and these kinds of things, it's like, obviously this is very simplistic, but all of them are doing the same thing, which is what? They're all trying to fulfill their own interest. And they're using whatever is in their power to be able to do so. Why wouldn't the woman in the relationship, conventionally, right? Why wouldn't she use overt means? Because she has a lacking of advantage in that aspect. She's not going to go over-dominate the guy that's bigger and stronger than, louder than her, has more money than her, as in most cases, or whatever it is, yeah? So she'll use the hidden, you know, the model goes in. This is, you know, how they talk about it. Means. And then you have the narc mum. Have you heard of this? The narc mum. A narcissistic mum. And you have all these terms about different types of narcissists. You know, you've got this one and that one. And these are, the point of the matter is, the assumption is always that we are free from this ability or this propensity to be egoistic and self-interested, and everyone else is doing it to us. And it's true that someone can be so pathological or neurotic, yeah, that they seem not to care at all about, and this is probably what they're referring to when they're talking about narcissism. But the question is, who really gets to set the criterion? Where does it become narcissism? Where does it stop being psychological egoism and start being psychological narcissism? This is a subjective criterion. Let's just completely be honest about it. And who gets to judge it? And who will be discriminated against the most in these analyses? Mostly, I would wager it would be the overt narcissist, because it's so obvious that what they're trying to do. The covert narcissist gets, you know, soft voice, calm, you know, this and that. But she's a monster, or he's a monster, right? Yeah, she's been trying to do it behind his back. She's still talking to her girlfriends about him. Maybe she's cheating on him. You know what I mean? Maybe she's doing all this kind of, maybe she's taking, stealing his mind, whatever it may be. But these are just hidden, but it's the same, you know, thing. So, these are just interesting side notes. I'm not convinced, I have to say, looking at the literature of, in psychology on narcissism, there's lots of books, popular books and academic works. I'm not convinced that this thing is a hard and fast science. I'm not convinced at all by that. And they refer to it really as a personality disorder. But who gets to really choose, okay, this person has the psychological disorder, and who's that? And the one who gets to choose that is actually in an authoritative position, by the way. You're giving that person a lot of power by choosing who is the bad guy and who's the good guy in this equation. And I think these are conversations that we need to start having, because if it's true, and I think we all have identified, that we've all got some kind of psychological propensity to self-interest, even the most seemingly giving person that you've ever seen in your life, then the labeling of narcissist, not narcissist, and this kind of language, that can be very damaging. It's like, you know, Islamic heresiology. this guy's a kafir, this guy's a mubtada. Who gets to choose? Who gets to choose? You know, it's the same thing. The psychologist can use this to blackmail, to harm somebody. Oh, he's a narcissist. We have to deal with him in that way. Or this person's that way. You have to do that. So we have to be careful of these kinds of things, especially in pastoral settings. Yeah. Now that we know the underpinning psychology behind it, we'll take all of their descriptions with a very heavy pinch of salt. Okay. We have to take it with a very heavy pinch of salt, because otherwise people can be abused in the community, being labeled. And otherwise, anyway, this is just a side. I don't know if you are following. Any questions on this point?
On Islamic paradigm, it's not necessarily wrong to think of yourself first, right?
Well, this is the next step, right? Yeah. Good. Islam has a diagnostic, okay? And this is the next slide. It has a diagnostic and it has a prescription, okay? The Islam diagnoses the human being as selfish and motivated by anxiety. It actually does that. It agrees with this to a large extent. You know, وَإِنْ أَذَقَنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَأُوسٌ كَفُورٌ. You know, when we have given the person mercy and then we take it away from him, he is ya'us, he's hopeless and kafur, he's very ungrateful. You know, obviously in the يَوْمَ يَفِرُّ الْمَرْءُ مِنْ أَخِيهِ, on the Day of Judgment, this is most acutely felt. Everyone's going to be running away from their own family members. It's the same human being, right? You're going to be running away from your mum and dad. What kind of? You can't say I'm altruistic. You know, one of them was going to want to ransom their lives with their kids and this and that. When the stakes go higher, we become more selfish. Basically, that's the model in Islam. The stakes go higher, we become more and more selfish. We say, no, we're not going to take that pain. There's a point where the pain becomes too much that we don't even care about our parents and our own kids. That's the idea. This agrees with ethical egoism on a psychological level to a high extent, in my view, right? Because look at the verses. How could you explain that? That means that the assumption is people are self-concerned.
Yeah.
They are.
Even the prophets.
Yeah, we won't go into this, you know. I know the hadith, nafsi,
yeah,
myself.
Yeah,
yeah.
They always make dua for themselves first, right? Rabbi Najini wa Ahli. We'll start with themselves first.
Yeah, we'll come to this, but you're on the right track, Sam, for sure. So this is a diagnostic. What does Islam say? Does it say you shouldn't think about yourself? It doesn't say that, by the way. Well, otherwise, Jannah and Nar would not be incentives. Heaven and Hell would not be incentives. If a lot of the incentives in the religion of Islam are based on the model that human beings are actually self-interested. You threaten them with more pain, because if you don't, then the more pain you threaten someone with, and the more they believe that that's actually a legitimate threat, the less likely they are to do the action. Mm-hmm. And you could say this is behavioralist psychology 101, and what's in the skin and the dog, and whatever. This is the truth.
You saw that now with the COVID.
Hmm?
You saw that with the COVID now.
Yeah, with COVID, but with, you know, if someone puts a gun to your head, you're going to change. Your whole demeanor is going to change.
My point is, it wasn't even that deep.
Yes. Exactly, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. Now, so Islam does. However, the Islamic model is the purpose of life is to worship God. And worshipping God, the apex of it is to worship God for what reason?
His pleasure.
Because he's worthy of worship. Not because... So, if you try and form an intention... Islam actually says, if you try and form an intention that says that I'm worshipping Allah, not because it's good for me, or because of heaven and hell, but because he's worthy of worship, that's a higher level intentionality than to do it for your own sake. Now, the question is, can someone completely, and I've thought about this a lot, can someone completely break off any notion of self-interest from this? I think that's difficult. I would say for me, because I can't speak on anyone else about, that's impossible.
Ghazali talks about that in his literature, doesn't he? He said the highest form is do it for the pleasure of Allah. And some people do it for the nar.
Yeah, exactly. So to do for the pleasure of Allah, to do it because Allah is worthy of worship. Yeah.
Mm.
However, is that the only reason why I'm doing it? It's going to be difficult. I would never say yes to that question. That would be me lying to you in front of your faces. I would. There's always an element of self-interest there,
yeah.
In my opinion, for me anyway. My aim is not to try and deplete that, because I don't think Allah has held me to that standard. And if He held me to that standard, there would be no heaven and hell. Worship Allah, no incentive, no disincentive. He knows what He created,
yeah.
And He created self-interested, to a large extent, beings.
Mm.
But we have to try and rid ourselves from this as much as we can.
Yeah.
We do actually have. And it's not inconceivable, the Islamic paradigm goes, for you to worship God because God is worthy of worship, because He has all these attributes, and that this is the most appropriate thing to do with a God like that, or the only God that's worthy of worship, which is Allah. Now, if you're worshipping Allah, like you're praying and you're fasting, and that's in your mind, that's the highest form of worship. That's actually the highest form of worship. Where you try and have an out-of-body experience, like you actually think to yourself, I'm doing this because God is worthy of worship. Even though the unconscious mind might say, you're a liar.
Yeah,
the unconscious mind will say to you, you're a liar. You're doing this because you feel good, don't you? Huh? But let the unconscious mind say whatever it wants to say. So long as you make a conscientious effort to say that to yourself when you're praying, this is khushu' level, high level, which is like, you know, when you're concentrating in the prayer. It's the highest level. There's no higher. This is the spiritual apex.
Muslims in Norway are now establishing a masjid and dawah center to enhance the Norwegian dawah. If you donate to this cause, you will inshallah reap the rewards of thousands of Muslims coming back to Islam, and many of those will become du'at and invite to Islam. So click the link and donate now and share the video for extra rewards.